Good evening, and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator, and it's my pleasure to introduce Victoria Wilson. As we begin, two things to point out. First, let's try to recreate the glamour of 1930s Hollywood by silencing cell phones or anything that might disrupt the presentation. We appreciate it. Second, our friends from the Corner Bookstore do have Ms. Wilson's book, Steel True, for sale in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery. You may take one look at the book and think, it's huge, and that's only volume one. But if you haven't yet read it, be assured it's worth the effort. As Jenny McPhee's review put it, it only covers the first 33 years of the actress's life with 50 more to go, but Wilson's take on Stanwyck's life and era is so commanding and delightful, I would happily read as many pages again and more. This opinion is echoed by every review. I'll just mention the one by film expert and library member Molly Haskell in the New York Times Book Review. If ever there was an actress who was ready for prime time, it is Stanwyck, and this enormously informative tribute, juicy yet dignified, admiring yet detached, is the book to bring her to center stage. Victoria Wilson is vice president and senior editor at Alfred Knopf. She was appointed by President Bill Clinton to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and has served on the boards of Pan American Center, the National Board Review of Motion Pictures, the writing program of the New School of Social Research, and Poets and Writers. Please join me in welcoming Victoria Wilson.
Hello, everybody. Thank you. Welcome. This is a wonderful room, actually. I'd like to thank Sarah Holliday, who's just fled. And, you know, I have to say, I spent a lot of my childhood, I grew up in Martha's Vineyard, but we moved to New York, and I spent a lot of my childhood in the stacks of this library. And it's a great library, and we're all lucky to have it. So, Barbara Stanwyck. Before I talk about her as Barbara Stanwyck, the one thing I want to say about her is that she was an extraordinary reader. Books really mattered to her. Reading mattered to her. In fact, it was a way that she coped with her loneliness. And it's interesting. I was asked to give a talk at the Mount a while back, and I thought, Edith Wharton and Barbara Stanwyck. Now, can I possibly connect those two people? But being the genius that I am, I did. And to begin with, Barbara Stanwyck's real name was Ruby Stevens, and Edith Wharton's grandmother, though married to a Rhinelander, was a Stevens. She was French. She was not New England. But what really connected the two was that when Edith Wharton was 23 or 24, she began to receive her education as a reader from Egerton Winthrop, who was a lawyer and a former president of the Knickerbocker Club and somebody who was very interested in society and fashion. And which was, as far as Edith Wharton was concerned, his weakness. But when he wasn't in that milieu, there was nobody better. And he began to educate her in terms of what she should read. And it was crucial. It was a major, major moment in her life and affected her for the rest of her life. Barbara Stanwyck, who did not come from Rome or spend time in Rome, Florence, Newport, Bar Harbor, and came from Brooklyn, began to get her reading education when she was 14. She didn't have Egerton, but she had Ruby Stevens, and she was well guided by Ruby Stevens because she educated herself and became this absolutely fantastic reader and read everything. As she says, at first she read junk, but then she began to read everybody and everyone, and reading was a crucial part of her life, even to the point when she had separated from Frank Fay and was recuperating. She spent her days sort of wandering in bookstores in L.A. and then would read. She read a book a day and then passed it on, eventually giving the books. And she was famous for this. And when I started doing, I was sort of into it by this point, You know, it's you can tell a lot by what people read, and this was to me a great clue. So of course I, like Nancy Drew, followed it. And Hunter's bookstore by that time in LA was no longer, I don't think it was in existence anymore, but somehow I managed to find the manager of Hunter's bookstore, who had always recommended, every week she would recommend books to Barbara. And you know, I asked her, I was able to ask her what she read, and you know, she was always looking, she was reading, but always looking for books that could be made into movies, and found many of them that she did want to make into a movie, among them The Fountainhead, which of course she didn't make, and that was the reason why she left Warner Brothers, but that's another story for volume two. So let me just talk a little bit about Barbara Stanwyck. And the major question that everybody asks me, not why is my book so long, but I'll get to that after, but why Barbara Stanwyck? And, you know, I publish a lot of biography. I publish a lot of cultural history at Alfred Knopf, and I publish a lot of biographies. And one day I got it into my insane head to write a biography myself. I work very closely with the people I publish, and they would, you know, they would call me and talk about their research, and I would help them and think about it and send them in other directions. And I thought, you know, I really like doing this. I'm going to do this myself. And I made a list of people who I thought would be good subjects, something that I do very frequently. And I thought, you know, I looked into Barbara Stanwyck. There had been a series of not very good books, very sort of lazy books about her. And when you really looked at the career, first of all, she had an amazing career. But let's just think about who she was on screen. She was not like anybody else. She was not typically beautiful. She projected intelligence, darkness, complication, underbelly. And, you know, there was sort of, in the darkness, there was, it wasn't quite twisted, but, and she was as sexy as could be. So what a great combination. But when you look at the range of pictures, I mean, she got to Hollywood in 1929, just as sound was coming in. In fact, she made a couple of silent pictures that were also simultaneously made into sound. And she worked all the way through, and then she made 88 pictures. And then she went into television, and she did 20 years of television. So really, her whole career really paralleled the second act of a history of the movies. I didn't realize at the time that I was going to be writing a two-volume book, I didn't really know what I was doing at all. I was just sort of led by instinct and some higher power. And when I realized I was this book was going to become two volumes, I ended it in 1940, and with the Remember the Night, which is a movie directed by Mitch Leisen, and it's a very important Stanwyck picture. And by that point, when the book ends, she's 33 years old. She's made 37 pictures. She's been in Hollywood for a little over a decade, and she has she's made four movies with Frank Capra, four movies with the great William Wellman. She's worked with George Stevens, King Vidor, Ruben Mamoulian, Cecil B. DeMille, Preston Sturges, Mitch Leisen, John Cromwell, King Vidor, and so she's already worked with the greats, and she hasn't attained the greatness that comes really in 1941, which is the height, where she's at the height of her career. It was an extraordinary history, and she had, what was interesting was she worked with these directors, Frank Capra and William Wellman, and what came out of them was interesting. For instance, she worked with Frank Capra, and Capra directed her after she had been in Hollywood a couple of years and was ready to head back to New York, where she had been a huge star. She had just become a huge star on Broadway, and starring in two plays. The first was The Noose, and the second was Burlesque, which was produced and directed by Arthur Hopkins, who was really an important producer, and who really, in a lot of ways, was interested in naturalism and went in that direction, and he took Barbara Stanwyck with him, and Burlesque was a big hit. And she had made a couple of terrible movies, and the moment came where she could have made this. She went to audition with, to Frank Capra, and he said, "You have to do a test," and she said, "I'm not doing a test," because she had already made a test. And the great story, of course, that people don't really know was that her husband, Frank Fay, took the test and called up Capra and said, "You have to see this test." And he made sure that he saw it. And Capra saw the test. And it's my contention that as he watched Barbara Stanwyck in this test, which was a scene that she had done from The Noose, which was the sort of central emotional scene that sort of stopped the show and made everybody just sort of stunned emotionally and then fly to their feet in an embrace of her work. He saw that test, and he basically, I think, began to fall in love with her. And so he put her in this movie called Ladies of Leisure, which nobody's ever seen, except perhaps for Jones Harris, who's sitting over there. And it's a great movie, and it's a surprising movie. But they then made three other movies together. And what's interesting about the movies is the sort of evolution, I think, of their relationship. Capra wrote the films, and you can see how he was falling in love with her, which happens again when he makes The Miracle Woman, which is when he's really fallen in love with her. And then Forbidden, which is really a movie, I think, about, even though he stole it from Fanny Hurst, it's really about being in love with a woman who's married to somebody else and who doesn't want to leave the husband, doesn't want to leave her marriage. And then, of course, the fourth movie is The Bitter Tea of General Yen, which is really a resolution of that relationship. So, and what Capra did for Stanwyck was that he totally freed her up. And so I write in the book not only about the movies, not only about her accomplishment in the movies, but what he allowed her to do, the freedom that he gave her, and what you see that she can do. When you see The Miracle Woman, you're stunned by everything this actress can do and the range. And it's quite extraordinary. And then when she worked with William Wellman, which she sort of did in a parallel way, he worked with her on a number of movies, and he took note of what was happening to that marriage. And my book really could have been called A Portrait of a Marriage, because it really follows the evolution or the disintegration of her marriage to Frank Fay, has anybody here ever heard of Frank Fay? Good. Okay. That's a good beginning. Most people have not heard of him. But, of course, for those people who haven't heard of him, he was the great... He wasn't really just a vaudevillian. He was an actor. He was a serious actor. And he was the man, really, who was, I think, the person who influenced all modern stand-up comedy really comes from Frank Fay. But he really, you know, when I interviewed Milton Berle when he was 97 years old, he remembered Frank Fay's routine from 1927. And he was a natural. He would come on stage, and it would seem as if he was just doing it off the cuff, improvising. And he was very still in his movements and very simple. He didn't tell jokes. He wasn't the butt of a joke. He didn't use props. And people like Jack Benny, George Burns, Bob Hope all revered him, and they all copied him, and they were all influenced by him. Jimmy Cagney actually said that he learned to act watching Frank Fay on stage. And Fay, again, was somebody who, as I say, was very natural. This was a big influence on Stanwyck, who had absolutely no training as an actress. She had taught herself to be an acrobatic dancer, and she had been in the shows and in the clubs, and that's how she'd made her way, and then bit by bit, she ended up in The Noose, and then, of course, went to Hollywood. She did not want to go to Hollywood. She had just been offered a part by Arthur Hopkins in Ma Chanel, which, of course, was a play that was based on the Ruth Snyder murder. Of course, 16 years later, she was in Double Indemnity, which, of course, was based on the Ruth Snyder murder. But anyway, so she really wanted to stay in New York, but Faye was desperate to go to Hollywood, and she'd been asked to go to Hollywood by Louis B. Mayer and by, I think, United Artists, but she had said no. Anyway, she ended up going. She made a couple of movies. She ends up with Frank Capra. But what I was saying about William Wellman is that Wellman watched the disintegration of this marriage, which I write about in great detail. I don't know, it's a miracle that I could piece it together, but I did, very close up. And I don't write about it in this jargon, but to me it was the classic sort of alcoholic marriage, because she was determined to make this marriage work. Excuse me. He was her family, he was her everything. And he was suffering from alcoholism, and I think he also, I don't know, I mean, I can't say he was manic depressive, I don't know what the term was. He was not well, he was not a well man, and it was progressing. And Wellman saw all of this, and eventually he wrote A Star is Born, and it was based on three other couples, but primarily it was based on Barbara Stanwyck and Frank Fay. And she also got a lot out of working with Wellman. She was freed with him. She loved how tough he was. And she loved the energy he provided on the set. But the thing that most people don't know is that Barbara Stanwyck came from an old New England family. She was born in Brooklyn, but there was a family that preceded hers. There were three very older sisters, 18, 19, and 20. And they came from a New England family, and her family is a daughter of the American Revolution. So when I started my research, I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. But it was interesting, because for anybody who's doing anything, like being alive, the best thing you can do is to follow your instinct, because it will take you to the right place. And I could write not one book, not two books, but three books on the research alone. And it was sort of great fun, and it was all mysterious. One of the major keys for me was a man had sent me a manuscript. It was a biography. I don't want to say who it was because I turned the book down. But I called him a couple of years later and asked him if he knew where the papers were for the subject of his book. And he said, oh, by the way, have you found Walda Mansfield? Did I know who Walda Mansfield was? No. And I said, I mean, I may have, but I don't remember. Frankly, it was so long ago. Let me just say that when I started this book, it was 1996, which was like being in the 18th century. There was no web, there was no Google, there was no anything. It was like, which was good, it was good. It was all character building. And I asked him, Walda Mansfield, there were the three girls who were in New York together. Barbara Stanwyck, Ruby Stevens, Mae Klutz, and Walda Mansfield, Dorothy Shepherd. Anyway, so he said, well, she's right in Laguna Beach, and you have to call her. And I said, well, I'll call her and talk to her on the phone. He said, no, you've got to come out here. You have to fly out here right away and talk to her. And I thought, oh, God, all right. And then, of course, it raised, all right, how am I going to do in the interviews? Are people going to talk to me? Well, I went and met her, and it was like the turning of the key, because she had spent these young years in New York as a showgirl with Barbara Stanwyck and Mae Clark, and it was the trio. And they made this pledge amongst themselves that they would only work together, and they did. They only appeared in nightclubs, in supper clubs, on rooftops, out in Atlantic City. They all appeared together. May Clark ultimately married Lou Bryce, who was Fanny Bryce's brother. And so I went to interview Walda, and you know, in the stories that she told me about the three of them, and she gave fabulous details. Barbara Stanwyck is no longer that woman on the screen. She became a human being to me. And that was the beginning of my working my way into this life and piecing together this life that I really... It wasn't just, though, the life that I was interested in. The next sort of interesting turning point was when I decided to go not to Hollywood to see where she lived. I wasn't interested in that. I wanted to go to Lanesville to see where her family came from. And Lanesville is right outside of Gloucester. It's a peninsula. And in the middle of it, there was a stone quarry. And so doing a lot of digging around, I went there. I saw where her family came from. And they had been... they had been ship's caulkers, and they had done very well in real estate, which was interesting to me because Barbara Stanwyck, at the end of her life, was very, very rich because she had invested very wisely, in real estate. So I thought that was interesting. But what was more interesting was to see these houses and to see, it was obviously right on the water. At the center of this peninsula, as I say, was this quarry. Her father had wanted to be a lawyer, and when his father died, he had to come home and get a job. And where did he get a job? In that quarry, and he became a stonemason. Well, all anybody ever wrote was, he was a stonemason, and that was the end of him. But I realized there was why he became the stonemason, and what happened after that? Well, first of all, what was going on while that quarry was in business? They were taking all of that granite on these huge sloops that would come into the harbor at Lanesville and taking them up and down the East Coast because they were building up the East Coast because it was the Industrial Revolution. Now, what was interesting to me about that was that, you see, here was this life. She hadn't even been born yet, but this family had already been shaped by the fact that there was this quarry, by the Industrial Revolution, by building up all of the cities, because ultimately the family left the small town, as many, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of other families did, and went to the big cities. And it was in going to the big city, and they ultimately moved, that first they went to Chelsea, then they moved to Brooklyn, that the family fell apart because the mother was pregnant with the sixth child, was thrown from a trolley, went into labor and died of septicemia, leaving Barbara Stanwyck, Ruby Stevens, without a mother and with a father who couldn't cope with the mother's loss. The three older sisters were making their own lives, and Ruby Stevens was passed from family to family. Some of the sisters could take care of her, but she was passed around the neighborhood. And imagine being 4 years old and you don't. And then the father, who couldn't cope with it, ran off and found work on the Panama Canal. So she is just left with her brother, who was 2 years older and who, of course, meant everything to her. And so imagine being 4 years old and not having a mother or a father. Well, you couldn't have had any better training for Hollywood. And, there was Stanwyck, Ruby Stevens, who basically said, there was nobody there to fight for me, and she fought for herself. And you can see in the way in which, just the way in which she conducted her business when she went to Hollywood, at that point, very few people were under contract to more than one studio. Stanwyck was always under contract to more than one studio. If not two, she was under contract to three, where her second husband, Robert Taylor, who came from this nice, happy, Goyesha family, from the Midwest, and, you know, had a very happy childhood, stayed at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer longer than any other actor under contract. I think he was there for like 60 years. And so that tells you something, and it completely shaped who she was, and it tells you what she was able to draw upon in those dark moments in those movies. Of course, you know, when she met Zeppo Marx, the fifth unfunny Marx brother, who said he'd had enough with the Marx brothers and decided to become an agent. And he took Stanwyck, he and his wife became very friendly with Stanwyck, and they became great pals. They started a thoroughbred ranch together, a breeding ranch together in Northridge, and it was very, very successful. It was really Zeppo Marx who said to Stanwyck, "You can do comedy." And up to that point, she was always doing what she called the get outs, where there's a moment in the film where she will say to some poor man, "All right, now get out." And she thought, well, I can't possibly do comedy. But of course, she tried it, and she could. And Zeppo Marx was crucially responsible for helping to shift her career in a really important way and open it out. So, I mean, in terms of my research, what I was interested in was not writing a standard Brands movie star biography. What interested me was writing about the life, not just the times, but what was going on. I mean, when she, you know, if you read in any book, it will say, okay, Willard Mack, who was another very successful writer, producer, and director at the time of Arthur Hopkins in the 20s. And David Belasco changed her name. Okay, but does anybody, you know, really know about David Belasco? And so I went to the Schubert archives up into the eaves, and they have a fabulous archive there, and found amazing articles about Belasco, who was at that time a god of gods. And so I write a lot about Belasco. I put together, if I had known, I would have brought it. I put together a whole slideshow of Stanwyck's life before she went to Hollywood, and the life in the late teens and the 20s. I mean, she was in the Ziegfeld Follies. And as an example of where I was led, I was writing about Stella Dallas, which is a movie that everybody loves. It was a turning point for her. It was a movie in which she got her first Academy Award nomination, and she didn't win, but she should have, because it's an extraordinary performance. And I noted that the woman who always did her hair was out on strike, and as a result of that, I just noticed that in passing. They went to the local school where they're teaching people, you know, colorist school, and they brought in a series of colorists to do her hair, and they practically destroyed her hair. And after that, she said, "That's the end of dyeing my hair." So that was interesting. But I thought, well, wait a minute, what about the crafts unions? And what about the fact there's Barbara Stanwyck crossing the picket lines to get to work? And of course, as far as she was concerned, she had no use for unions. And in fact, the Screen Actors Guild had to force her to join the union and said that if she didn't join the union, she would be kicked out of Equity. So she joined the union. But anyway, in doing all of that and seeing, you know, what was happening while Hollis Barnes was on strike, I started to write about, well, why were they on strike and what were they striking for? And I tell the whole story of the crafts union strikes, and then the Screen Actors Guild, and these were people who had million-dollar contracts: Clark Gable, Joan Crawford, Franchot Tone, Robert Montgomery, people who were ready to go out on strike. And who were they striking for? They were not striking for themselves. They were striking for the extras who were paid nothing, who had no coverage, who had no protection, who had terrible working hours. And that's who they were striking for. And this was a big deal. So they were ready to go out on strike. And then, of course, at the last minute, all the great studio heads got together and said, yes, that SAG could be the negotiating instrument for the union. And so I tell that story. I had no intention of telling that story, but I was led through it, and in the end, it's a fabulous story, and it's a great story about Hollywood. And of course, it's to the very end, the actors are perfect, because after they settle with the producers, what do? They come back in, and they leave the poor crafts union people on strike. No, they said, okay, basically, sayonara, you're on your own. But, you know, again, that it was telling, it was useful, and so the book, somebody sitting in the front row asked me why the book was so long. The book was even longer, and the reason why it was long is because one doesn't just exist in without a context. And she worked with these people. They were fabulous. They were great personalities. Some of them were horrible people. Some of them were bastards. But the effect, they were somehow all connected with her. When I wrote about 10 Cents a Dance, which was a movie directed by Lionel Barrymore, though he was mostly asleep during the direction because he had terrible arthritis and he was on drugs. At the end of the movie, I was fortunate enough to realize that at the last day of shooting, the stock market crashed. So, you know, she's in the world. The stock market has just crashed. So I was able to write about that. And then, of course, the studios, many of them were affected, as the rest of the world, by the Depression and what happened, as she is making more and more and more thousands of dollars a week. And there was the sort of unreality to that, as she is playing the women that she's playing, who could have been hash slingers or streetwalkers or, you know, professional equestrians. I mean, there was a whole range of, you know, fake faith healers. The range of performances is extraordinary. And I had a fabulous time. And then there came the moment where Barbara Stanwyck became two volumes, and I shaped the two volumes into this one volume, and I'm at work on volume two, which is the rest of her life, from 1940 to 1990, and it's an extraordinary, that in itself is an extraordinary saga. So I haven't really begun to tell you about her, but I think this is... you know, this will give you a sense of who she is, what she accomplished, and what the book is. And if there are any questions, I would be delighted to take any questions. Yeah. There are, yes, there are some. Well, let's see. I could say, you know, she said, you know, she was always, well, I had a mother and a father, so I did have people to fight for me. But I just think the sense of independence and strength, she was a hell of a lot tougher than I am. A lot tougher. Yeah. Yeah. It's a real story, and I wrote about it, and that's where you read it. I don't know if you read the book, but whoever was writing about it. Because I went to Florida one for a 2-week holiday, and I just happened to find a woman who traveled with Stanwyck and when she was, you know, 15. And she confirmed that Stanwyck, which I had thought, because what Stanwyck had, first of all, let me just say that Stanwyck never lied to me, except for once. And that was that she claimed that she was a bleeder, and that's why she couldn't have children. And I always knew that was couldn't have been the case. And here's why. You can't do the stunts that she did herself if you're a bleeder. You're just not going to be doing that. And Nancy Bernard confirmed that she had had an abortion, and it had not gone well, and she couldn't have children. And I think, do I know what would have happened had she been able to have children? Well, she adopted a child. She was intent on adopting a child when Frank Fay was basically having a nervous breakdown because his career was going nowhere, as in A Star is Born. She was ascending, and he was going crazy. Vaudeville was dying out, and Warner Brothers, which is where he was under contract, didn't have the slightest idea of what to do with him. Here was a man who was funny and elegant, and they kept making him into a Spanish lover. So his career was going absolutely down the tubes. And she insisted at that moment that she had to have a child. And they adopted a child, and it was a happy story for a while, and then it wasn't a happy story. And I found the son. And the way I found the son, again, this was before there was any anything. It was like, you know, you pick up the phone and dial, or you go to the archive. And of course, I went to every archive from New York to Hollywood to do all of this research. A friend of mine said that she knew someone who was in charge of security for the when the Pope came to New York, and he might be able to help me. And I thought, okay, fine. So I called this man up. He came into Knopf, and I thought he was an assassin. He carried a briefcase, and God only, I thought, oh, God knows what's in there, probably a Luger of some kind. And remember, it's long before any kind of web existed or internet, and I said, this is who I'm looking for. Can you see if you could find him? And of course, he probably went on NexisLexis, which he had access to then, but nobody else did. And 2 days later, he found him, and I thought, okay, so the worst that's going to happen is that he'll say, no, I don't want to talk to you. Well, I ended up, I never met him. He refused to meet me, not because he didn't want to meet me, but because he was ashamed of the way he looked. He didn't have teeth, or a lot of his teeth. And, you know, Nancy Sinatra Sr. was she sort of took me under her wing, and Nancy was Barbara Stanwyck's closest friend. And she sort of adopted me. In fact, I used to call her at night and read her chapters over the phone. And I said, look, do you think it's okay if I send the money to the dentist for his teeth? Because you can't pay your sources. And she said, I think that's all right. Well, I offered, and he did not want to do that. So I never met him, but I spent years interviewing him. He told me things that nobody ever would have known. And many things that actually I didn't use because my instinct just said not to use them, but they were upsetting. And the story between Stanwyck and Tony Fay gets darker and darker in volume two.
Hi.
She left a huge estate worth many tens and tens of millions of dollars. And that was when she died in 1990, and it wasn't to be opened until 2013. So I can imagine what it was worth by the time it was opened. And she left it to her grand nieces and nephew. And she left $5,000 to Tony Fay, because when Frank Fay had died, he hadn't left any money to Tony. And Tony broke the will. So she left a stipulation. There was a stipulation for all those who want to do this, for those who you're not crazy about. She left a stipulation saying, there's $5,000 for Tony Fay, and if there's any attempt to contest it, he doesn't get anything. I'm sorry? Well, it wasn't just about strictness. Well, you've read the book, right? Well, so you have to read volume two. It's a complicated story. And but I think part of it was that her sense of perfection, I mean, sort of what you're saying, her sense of perfectionism. And, you know, he was cute, and then he wasn't cute. He started to get heavy. There was a complication about another boy. He wasn't gay, but a lot of things happened. And I write about them in this book. You know, in fact, there's one moment where I describe his being taken by somebody who used to be in vaudeville with Stanwyck's sister, which I didn't even go into that, but that's how she became an actress. I mean, I do in the book, but not today. He's being taken to this military school. He's 5 years old. And part of it was that that was what was being done in Hollywood with these children. They were being sent off to military school or to private schools or whatever, but very, very young. And when I reread it, I used a lot of his words. When I reread it, I was stunned by the amount of the sort of overwhelming feeling of loneliness that came up. And that really didn't come from me, but that came from my using his words. And he was a very lonely boy. There was only one child, and after a certain point, Stanwyck had absolutely nothing to do with him. She paid for him, she took care of him, but she refused to see him. So, let's put it this way, she wasn't a perfect person. Hi. Did you have your hand up? Oh, you? Do you have another question, Anya? Well, I'd have to say Lady Eve it's a masterpiece. But Remember the Night is also a great movie. You know, Sorry Wrong Number is a stupendous movie. But, you know, if you look at Miracle Woman, you're blown away by that. If you look at, even with its flaws, Stella Dallas is an extraordinary performance. And when she did it, you know, she was 30 years old. That's 29. As I say in the chapter title, a dangerous age to be. Nobody wanted to touch that role because, you know, of the way she looks and because she's the mother of an adult girl or, you know, a teenager. And she went all out. I mean, she did not hold back. And, you know, she was wearing about 20 pounds of packing on her body. And when you're about to turn 30, that's very dangerous. But she braved it. Yeah, hi.
Hi, I have read the book, and assuming, or maybe not, that you started at some point chronologically going through her life, then did you also watch the films chronologically?
I did. I watched the films chronologically to see how she changed, yes. Oh, yes. The question was, I wrote the book chronologically, but did I also watch the movies chronologically? And let me tell you that it wasn't, oh, I can just call, you know, go to Amazon. There was no Amazon. For good or ill. And, you know, you couldn't just get a DVD. I had to gather up from collectors all of those movies on tape. And I watched them over and over and over again. Anything else? Hi. Well, you know, well, here's the thing. I mean, I've thought about that, but there are plenty of people who have been orphans who have turned into loving mothers. And I think that, you know, I think it was who she was. It was who she was. And I think that she had a very loving relationship with Frank Fay, but he basically had to sort of teach her how to be with another person because she was so into withdrawn, basically, that he would say, well, that's what I'm here for, to help you. You know, tell me what's going on. Why are you upset? And it wasn't something that was second nature to her, like as if you would go to your mother or your father and confide in them. She only had herself and her brother, who left very early, in fact, to go find the father. He went to the, you know, he shipped out in the merchant marines, made his way to Panama and found that the father had died. But, you know, the thing about it is the sadness. Think about the sadness. It's what comes across. It's that complication. It's that darkness. It's how I started. It's all of that stuff that you see on the screen that makes her so interesting and makes her so lasting. I mean, you know, as Edith Wharton, going back to Edith Wharton, I found these quotes that she said, "Life is always either a tightrope or a feather bed. Give me the tightrope." And that's what Stanwyck lived. And, you know, she, at another point, Wharton says, "Silence may be as variously shaded as speech." And that's the way Stanwyck acted. That silence, that stillness that comes through, that makes her such a glorious actress. Any other questions? Yeah. She had one or two movies, but they were reels. You know, when she died, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, when I said to my mother I wanted to write a biography of Barbara Stanwyck, she said, "Why would you want to write about Barbara Stanwyck?" And I said, "Well, who do you think I should write about?" And she said, "Well, why don't you write about Jules Verne?" And, you know, it wasn't until, that was a long time ago, and it wasn't until recently that I sort of figured out why she said that. And that was, my theory is that people do things, like if you look at the great movie makers, they made the movies of the books they read as children. And people do things, what's important to them that they carry into their adult life and that they act out of is what was important to them in childhood. And I thought, well, my mother read Jules Verne, and it meant something. You know, she was given all these other worlds, these fantastically imagined worlds. For me, it was the early show and Million Dollar Movie. Hi. Well, they were very close. They worked very well together, but he ultimately married because she wasn't going to leave Frank Fay. But you can see it in the movies, and that's why I wrote about it in the way that I did. Okay, I guess that's it. Well, thank you all for coming.